interrupting. The current neo-Uronial climate challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy starved, alien invaded, and nuclear glowing postulated cricketism to bring you behind a woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting episode BTWRLM 600. That's right. That's how many episodes I've been doing, estimated at least, at reallibertymedia.com. I hope we can do some more. And your generous donation will help continue to do that. We're right at the end of our time here, so please find the donate buttons or send the crew a coffee, if you will, KO-FI, and we'll see what we can do. But remember, being free is not a spectator sport, so get you behind a woodshed, because you don't know what you missed until you get behind a woodshed, and it's pretty much that simple. As I've explained, you think you know something until you start doing it with these folks that seem to run our lives into the ground, and you realize that it's not quite what we're told. And there's a whole lots of reasons for it, and yet, underneath it all, it's the core of it still there to rely on, and that's what I focused on a long time ago, and that seemed to start causing a big difference in things that were going on. People, especially miners, being able to get their equipment back from, they're stolen by agencies, not supposed to mess with you, but no, they're like, not messing with Texas, no, they're not supposed to mess with the miner either, or any producer, or any land disposed to anybody, and yet they've messed this whole place up. And so we aren't really enjoying all this. And part of that reason, when you get into how they started to do that, was on the administrative side. I just said agency, administrative side of it. Administrative rules was regulations, not laws. They act as law, like you're as money. So there's a process that you can go in. There's another one that popped up here for us, and particularly to this communication, this whole Internet of Things. The FCC is looking into the impact of the broadband data caps and why they still exist. And so here's an agency, has a jurisdiction over a certain subject matter, happens to be the Internet in this case, and they want to inquire, performing an inquiry about the impact of broadband data caps. This is something you can step up and consider to make a comment. This is how it all starts. It gives you, this is really simple. There's no threat here, especially this one. There's no threat whatsoever that I can tell. And you can make your comment and be part of that thing. And if it's something comes down, you can then be, when you make your comment, then it gives you standing to move on if there's rights or so being violated. The FCC is still taking comments from the public about how much data you really use and what your experience with data caps is like. The Federal Communication Commission is officially looking into broadband data caps and their impact on consumers. On Tuesday, the FCC approved a notice of inquiry to examine whether data caps harm consumers and competition, as well as why data caps persist, quote, despite increased broadband needs and the, quote, technical ability to offer unlimited data plans, quote, unquote. As spotted earlier by the Engadget, many Internet plans come with a data cap limits how much bandwidth you can use each month. If you go over that data cap, Internet service providers will typically charge an extra fee or slow down your service. The FCC first started inviting consumers to comment on broadband data caps last June, and hundreds of which you can now read on the agency's website. And I'll interject, that's very important to go read through some of those to get an idea of what's being talked to. You still have to do your qualification on whether it's a valid comment. They're looking for something specific, and I'll get to that in a second. So here's your... It's been happening since June. You still have a chance to come in and bring your experience and what they're looking for. And, you can still share that experience with the broadband data caps with the FCC through the form that's involved on this link that you can get, or go to the FCC website, I'm sure, which will ask for details about the name of your ISP, the usage limits, and any challenges you've encountered due to the cap. Personally, avoiding my ISP's broadband data cap has become increasingly difficult with all the shows I've been streaming in the storage-heavy games I download each month. It's actually one of the reasons why I started watching DVDs again. The FCC at least started making ISPs more clearly disclose the terms of their plans in a new, quote, nutrition labels mandated earlier this year. For most people in the United States, rationing their Internet usage would be unthinkable and impractical, FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel said in the press release. The restricting the consumer's data can cut off small businesses from their customers, slap fees on low-income families, and prevent people with disabilities from using the tools they rely on to communicate. I would interject right there, just the connection at all, just having any access now in lots of places, especially with all that money that was supposed to be dumped into the rural areas where communication is very difficult to get a hold of relative to this wireless stuff, and that no one really got part of that at all. Like we hear, you ask for a $750 check after Helene dumped all over you, and you likely, all the stories I've heard, except one, I think it was, have been denied. So you don't get the benefits. And all this is going to have to start changing. But without interaction, they don't even know any of us are here. And so get the link, download the FCC PDF. I'll give you a link for that right on the broadcaster if you go there. With the FCC Exploring How Broadband Data Caps Impacts Competition and Consumers is the title of that. And so look very carefully at what they want to see. Don't go off and run a new and blaze a new trail. Well, unless you can tie something into the impact that they may not have considered. But keep your dots really close together to what they're interested in. Otherwise, your comment gets disregarded. And if you go to challenge it, it's not relevant either. So it's not going to work in the long run. But the agency released hundreds of consumer stories and launched a formal inquiry on the impacts of the internet usages. So consider what you need to say relative to what the FCC needs to hear. Read some other comments, as I said, then make your own comment and stay on point again. It's so important. A lot of people just go off, and you really can't in some of this. Most of this agency stuff, and because they get to the various subject matters as they get to them, and we can't push that. Okay. So this is also a federal communication because that's commerce. So understand that jurisdiction as well a little bit. See what the ballpark you're playing in, and consider then all that any pertinent information which might need to be added relative to the CC's interest that it might not have appreciated, and also needed to consider relative to the original inquiry. So understand what they're asking for. It's so important. Made it pretty simple. You can send by letter, you can do by email or whatever. I say do this because it gets you in the practice of responding to the government. You don't have to make it so important that I would do, like we did with the mining district. Literally writing why the law shouldn't or should be in, or the jurisdiction wasn't. I've told you about the one case about the waters of the United States definition. We commented on that. That case went to the courts. The Jefferson Mining District decided when seven different attorney generals got involved, we wouldn't go because what they had said was essentially what we said in different words. So that regulation was overthrown pretty decisively. So you get the opportunity when you comment to be one of those people that goes to court if you need to. And I think this is important because, like I said, there's no jeopardy, and you get to exercise something we've been told about, this thing in the system, the establishment, how laws work and how you reinforce them. And no, hardly anybody ever got practiced in it. And I found this is a really interesting way to get at it. So please, if you have a gripe, take it to the FCC, listen for what they want, and listen very carefully and watch how people have responded. And if you see something completely off point, make sure you don't do that. It's really just the whole point. You're not going to make a new argument. That's not what they're there for that comment. So it's, like I said, this is pretty simple stuff. It gets you thinking along the lines that I can tell you it's practice for anything else you do officially with anybody. You start to understand what you're up against as well. The networks in your practice, everyday practicing of things as you interact with other people, too. You don't speak like a lawyer or nothing, but you understand, you start understanding what the elements of the pertinent things you need to speak to and what's relevant to that and what's material to that. So last week I read the first part of Elon Musk as Tesla 2.0, the legacy of Technocracy Incorporated and the push for a North American technate, where we have Elon Musk quoted in 2019 as saying, accelerating starship development to build the Martian technocracy. And as we watch now, the new techno swamp Trump is courting as this election period's coming forward and near to an end pretty soon. And I was thinking about this again, that they're both the selection of the choice of evils. In some regard, you're actually having to limit evil. So you're going to have to choose the one that's going to create the least evil, I think, is really the point here. And I can't, as I've said before, he may not have cleared the swamp, but he certainly brought a relief economically. And that may be the least evil that we can accept that he's going to do, that we think he's going to do. And I think that's the best path at this point myself, just to let you know if you need a reason, if that's any much of a reason. But for those of you that vote, and for those of you that can influence your elector, more importantly, to vote, I'm thinking even this techno swamp, it's going to get us at least down the road of the technocracy, probably quicker technologically. But we can still say no to that. You can't say no to something like Gaza. You can't say no to something like Ukraine. You can't say no to something like the policies that are made, the opening the borders. We really don't have that. So that's not the kind of thing we get to do. So consider all that. I'm not making a pitch. I'm just saying it's a bad condition. We're looking at two people that really meet the muster, but because of the fervor and cheerleading around it, people generally think they can choose, and they think that someone's going to be different than, I mean, to actually do what they say. There's no evidence at that point, and that's the whole point about look for the evidence of these things. But we went too far here on that. It's not really it's important, but it's just something. It's a big ring in everybody's nose, it seems, and it's really gotten us off point. And to the point, I'm telling you, go comment to the FCC, because that's maybe one of the only things you have to flex your muscles, really, in doing something and getting some real service out of the Internet that was supposed to be set up for the people, essentially. It was a military tool, but that was all for us as well. In other words, the highways you get to use every day, and I know you have to pay for them because no one understands your right of ingress and egress. And the system is set up around that to shut everybody down. So we haven't got together to stop all that. But even so, the government need actually compress that, and you get to ride behind it. Why are you being charged? Why are you being limited? Why is there this limit, is what they're asking. What is the impact against you? Or my experience, another issue on that, when you don't have connectivity or very good connectivity, your data cap means like zero when you can't get data. You get all this data that doesn't work. And so you blow through your data real quick, and you haven't gotten anything. There's no guarantee. And the carrier denies that they're even keeping track, and that's a lie. We can go through the whole thing. So I'm not going to go through that for this, but because I want to get back to the techno swamp is up around our ears. And so I'm not sure how we get rid of that. But we can be more vocal about it for sure. We can make our comments, and we can give our place. We can carry a long stick to stick in their spokes if we did it administratively, and there's no jeopardy in that. I just have never found, there's never been a problem addressing agencies with comments. It's pretty neat. And you get to engage it and listen and watch how the amoeba works in a way. You want to talk about the Hegelian dialectic? You go look at that. You want to understand it? You go start looking at that. You want to just spew words, or do you want to understand what the thing is that we're up against? Because all this executive, the president is the executive. He's going to have regulations. He's going to have rules. He's going to have comments that need to be made. This so-called efficiency. Remember, I hope you have tied that together. Technocracy was about efficiency. Where is Elon Musk being said to might be put if Trump gets in? The efficiency department for the government. How neat, huh? So I want to get touched back on this. I want to pick up from last week, and I want to read the end, at least for this section, of part 13, the Tesla myth, just another magic show. And I want to tie more concretely the observations I mentioned last episode, the earmarks of things unseen, of open deceptions playing out, especially today. Or, for instance, as stated in the essay of that Nikola Tesla was one of the most widely published scientists in his own day, with coordinated mass media coverage of everything he said broadcast out regularly to the American people from coast to coast. And as I have complained, why is Elon Musk seemingly everywhere? The answer man, the savior. On subject matters, I can't even imagine him talking about it. But there he is. His face is like in everywhere. His voice is everywhere. His print is everywhere. And I don't really understand it, except you start looking at the statements here in this article, this essay. The Tesla myth, just another magic show. And it starts to make more sense that we're watching. It answers a lot of the things that didn't gel for me about Nikola Tesla. Some brilliant things came out, but a lot of them couldn't be tested through. And you always make, when you hear that, you're sold into, well, maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just the materials I'm using. When you try to design, build his stuff by instruction, and you read about how it was constructed, you start, well, is it the materials? Because I'll tell you, that does and can have an effect big time. We're dealing in, if you will, what's the ether? Most people, science won't agree with it, but the ether, this is subtle energies going on here. And some of you have experienced that, and so you know that they're there. It's just how do we tap into them? How do we utilize what they do? I don't want to say their force, they're just nature. Getting to here, so you do your best, you see, and then you notice lots of things aren't working. But you have these questions because, oh, this guy's the greatest. But then we see here decades later, it all might have been a prop. It all might have been another kabuki theater, another setup. While the real show was going on outside and everyone was ripping off the stuff in your car while you're in the theater. Carefully crafted image of Nikola Tesla as the starving genius, impoverished, bankrupt, and debt-ridden has been passed down for generation to generation over the last century. There is even a popular myth that Tesla was reduced to digging ditches to make ends meet. Financial power brokers despised him for his efforts to bring utopia of free zero-point energy to humanity, and the world ignored his gifts during and after his lifetime. From his 1893 arrival in the United States of America until his death in 1943, Tesla lived in the best luxury hotels of New York, often in penthouse suites and often patronized by the wealthiest financiers, oligarchists, families of the Eastern establishment such as John Pierpont Morgan, Jacob Astor, and George Westinghouse. To be specific, from 1899 to 1910, Tesla lived in the posh old Waldorf Astoria, followed by the Hotel St. Regis in McGurry, and in the Pennsylvania, the Governor Clinton, and finally the New Yorker from 1934 until his death in 1943. The New Yorker was the preeminent luxury hotel of New York, servicing over 30,000 guests, featuring over 12 dining halls, the largest barbershop in New York, and a self-contained hospital. Pretty magnificent, huh? Where do we see some of that anymore? During his years, also consider the cultures then, what was popular, what was done, how people did things. During his years living in luxury suites, Tesla was known for hosting the most elaborate dinner parties in the town, hobnobbing with the elite families of the United States of America and Europe, serving unbounded champagne and caviar. Whatever debt issues Tesla faced, they were not made better by these years of lavish parties, which sort of undermines the image of a poor recluse genius. Additionally, Tesla was one of the most widely published scientists in his own day, with coordinated mass media coverage of everything he said broadcast out regularly to the American people from coast to coast. So I'll restate that again, as I complain about this guy, Elon Musk. Potentially, it looks like to me, as I called him out before, what he was bringing on, long before this article, Tesla 2.0, and now we see his family's tied to establishing the North American Technate, and his comment is, we're going to Mars to establish technocracy. And yet, here we are, Tesla 2.0, he's Elon Musk, is everywhere, media everywhere, media savvy, everywhere, I mean, every, I don't care, I don't know how anybody can do so much as I see him and where he's at, everywhere. Now, rather than seeing any evidence of the corporate press or major universities ignoring underappreciated genius, we find that within minutes of his arrival to the United States of America, every effort was made by the leaders of the most prestigious universities and scientific institutions to bestow upon honorary doctoral degrees by Columbia and Yale University, both in 1894, and the Elliott Cresson Medal from the Franklin Institute. He was additionally made an honorary member of the National Electric Light Association and a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Again, this is within the first few years of his arrival of the United States. Beyond the myth of starving genius, the only other Tesla myth that has grown even larger is the myth of Tesla, the scientific genius. This is in a caption heading Serious Questions Pertaining to Tesla's Inventions. In parts 1 to 12 of our story thus far, we have established several important things pertaining to the person of Nikola Tesla. Number one, his enthusiastic promotion of the oligarchic science of eugenics to eliminate useless eaters. Two, his fondness of members of the occult and oligarchic orders of the world. Three, his support for Sir Isaac Newton, a Rosicrucian Kabbalist, in opposition to the discoveries of anti-Newtonian scientists like Einstein. Number four, his mentors, who were leading members of the Rosicrucian Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and Society for Psychical Research. Five, the influence of Thomas Huxley, ex-club, on Tesla's thinking. Six, Tesla's obsessive efforts to disprove the existence of soul and even free will. Seven, Tesla's promotion of behavioralism and radical empiricism as standards of good science. And eight, Tesla's promotion of green energy tech, such as solar power, as replacements for hydrocarbon or nuclear forms of energy. And as I'm reading this, some of these things I'm not checking them off as a perfect agreement. I'm saying, just read this, see what this guy has found. If you go study some of the technology, I can say the solar panels were more of this energy that science won't even recognize. And there is some evidence of its existence, and yet we still can't quite tap it. And so that creates that question. However, he had, again, there's energy that would come in at night. He had collectors that would collect it. Have I been able to do that? No. So I'm missing something. I didn't quite get the right notes. However, we even established in part two and part one that two of the Tesla's transmission towers in Long Island, Wardenclyffe and the German-financed Telefunken wireless station at Sayville, were assessed by the United States Naval Intelligence Office to be a hub of German occult espionage during World War II, leading to both towers being demolished before the war's end. This question has vast implications. Tesla loudly proclaimed himself to be the inventor of Guglielmo Marconi's radio, explaining to the press that many of the electrical elements Marconi used in his radio had been patented and that he would have made the discovery if he was looking for a way to transmit messages, which he wasn't. Thus, Tesla believed that he should receive credit for the discovery instead of Marconi. 6 months after Tesla died, a Supreme Court declared Marconi's radio patents void, suggesting Tesla to have been correct in his claims. However, the justices of the Supreme Court relied on rather circumstantial evidence than even Tesla did claim to have while he was alive, which did manage to add more fuel under the brewing flames of the post-World War II Tesla cult. Why was such an effort made to graft this story onto the mass psyche after Tesla died? Tesla also had no problem claiming he had discovered X-rays prior to William Roentgen's 1895 discovery, which is also hailed by the devoted fans of Tesla to this day. The problem is that the evidence is lacking due to the inconvenient or convenient fact that Tesla's New York laboratory burned down in 1895, destroying all evidence of his claims. In this case, he joins his Rosicrucian predecessor, Sir Isaac Newton, who avoided having to prove to the world how he made his incredible discoveries when his dog burned down his laboratory. Dog ate my homework, I suspect, too, right? This trend of lab burning down proofs of discovery also extends to Tesla's claims of having invented the radio. When asked to prove that his induction coil, which he professed to have built and used to make the first radios to transmit information across the Atlantic years prior to Marconi's in 1901 breakthrough, Tesla once again declined since the evidence was destroyed in his famous 1895 lab fire. Sad. Tesla is perhaps most famous for having discovered the Tesla coil, but even this is questionable since it is widely recognized that Elihu Thompson appears to have invented it independently, possibly prior to Tesla. Elihu Thompson appears to be the close collaborator to Thomas Edison and a leading industrialist inventor of the 19th century. In 1892, Elihu's company, Thomas Houston Electric Company, merged with Edison General Electric Company to become the General Electric Company. It is possible that Tesla, a.k.a. the human automaton, was carefully positioned by his handlers to infiltrate the Edison Company when he was inserted into its Paris offices in 1883 and then brought into the United States in 1884. Tesla's stay at the Edison Company only lasted about a year before he quit due to his suffering under a jealous Thomas Edison, who is obviously a villain in this whole story. Why did Tesla quit? According to legend, Edison had promised $50,000, over $1.2 million in today's currency, to any employee who could fix a technical issue at one of Edison's factories. When Tesla took up the challenge and designed a new motor to solve the mysterious problem, he asked Edison for the promised bonus. The apocryphal tale features Edison cruelly laughing at the great inventor, then telling him that the offer was an American joke, whereby an indignant Tesla quit in protest. At least that is the popular myth driven entirely by Tesla's testimonials by journalists years later. The fact is that it is improbable that the story is true. A junior electrical engineer would likely not receive $50,000 in 1885 dollars simply for doing his job, and Edison had never made any such offer before and after the supposed case with Tesla. Besides that, no other evidence has ever been presented that this is true. What really happened? Will we ever know? We know that Tesla was granted over 300 patents over the course of his career, and that is no small number of inventions. Is there evidence that these patents were his own, or were all or some of them stolen from the others, as had been done for Sir Isaac Newton earlier? Let me interject as well. Because there's a patent doesn't mean it works. It may be novel in that regard, that it's never been seen before, and it may use principles that appear to be scientific, but there's no requirement. There used to be models that you had to make. There's no requirement, actually, that these ideas work, just that you've discovered something. A lot like a mining claim. You discovered the gold, but you have to produce that, and you have to prove it, if you're challenged anyway. See how that works. It's pretty simple to say. These are grants of some things, and this is intellectual property law. Certainly, Tesla's proclivities of self-promotion, attacking those he perceives to be his enemies, Edison, Einstein, Roentgen, Marconi, etc., and simply lying, leaving a bitter taste in the mouth. So we will leave it up to the future researchers to continue to probe the depths of this important topic and see if more evidence can be gleaned indicating whether or not the real Tesla and his discoveries live up to the myth, the wizard of electricity. One researcher named Jeff Johnson, an accomplished electrical engineer and researcher, wrote a powerful critique of Tesla and the mystique of the cult built up around him in the 1994 edition of Skeptical Inquirer. Since Mr. Johnson has the technical expertise to venture where I cannot go, and since I find his arguments persuasive, I will end this essay with an extract from the 1994 article, leaving the ultimate judgment up to the reader's scrutinizing mind to ponder. Extraordinary Science and the Strange Legacy of Nikola Tesla by Jeff Johnson. Tesla's fans credit him with a long list of inventions and discoveries. These include radio, a bladeless steam turbine, fluorescent lighting, robotics, dithermy, the laser, vertical takeoff aircraft, pulsars, and much more. Ironically, these people seem least enthusiastic toward the one area in which historians in science and technology give Tesla unqualified credit. The AC power technology. He is generally credited with two ubiquitous inventions, the induction motor and the polyphase power transmission. All Tesla fans love his induction motor, but many fear the current that makes it go. Yet this is really the only area in which Tesla succeeded in developing a concept into a practical reality. In his honor, the scientific unit of magnetic induction or magnetic flux density is named the Tesla. In other areas, Tesla's achievements are not so impressive. A good example is radio. In the mid-1890s, Tesla developed all the components needed to construct a practical radio system, but seems to have lost interest. He never took his ideas beyond some very short-range demonstrations. This left the field open to Guglielmo Marconi, whom Tesla despised, who would prove the feasibility of long-range wireless communications just a few years later. Marconi did. This leads to a Tesla paradox. Although he anticipated Marconi and others in many ways, excellent histories of early radio need make only incidental mention of Tesla. Two books together make an excellent history of early radio technology are Syntony and the Spark and the Continuous Wave, both by U.G.J. Aitken. This paradox recurs throughout Tesla's life. His bladeless turbine may have been conceptually sound, but difficult and expensive to manufacture, and it may have had technical characteristics that limited its appeal. Tesla fans are inclined to resent this. I interject, in trying to do that one, that's one of those things you say, what am I doing? You read and read, and you do your thing, and it's just not quite working out like they said. Yeah, it has the physical science behind some of it, but in application, it was very difficult to put together. And again, there was not much proof of a lot of this. Even though, like I said, at least your mind starts to pick up things that are in there. When he talks about frequency, anybody who works with the coils, and I talked to you about resonance, you start understanding about frequency. You start understanding about this energy. You start getting better glimpses of what's going on. And there's subtlety, the subtle energies that seem to be there that are really hard to get a connection to. And yet, you can use the idea without being able to perfect it in order to design things. As I've explained to you, I started to see something myself, and I designed from an idea, what I thought I was looking at, based on what I thought I could make, a theory about. I created a device that did exactly what I thought it would do, without even fully understanding it, but knowing the interrelations of frequency, of energy, subtle energies being incorporated. And so there's this truth that sits inside this, but it's not really, it doesn't really come, bring itself out. And the Tesla turbine is one of those devices. Very interesting. A lot of science looks like it would work. And yet when you put it in application, it's very difficult to get the kind of power and transmission that he was saying. That could just be as well, I'm all thumbs when I construct things. I don't know. I've never really seen anybody that could put out a Tesla turbine that was actually to the claims that Tesla had made. Okay, that is all aside. This is in testing this thing, and because I see a problem for us today in someone who took the name Tesla, and now it looks like the same promotions are going on, the same things, and the same types of subject matter underneath being secretly, if you will, brought away unless you see it, unless you know the subject matter, the bringing it along is in this guy, Elon Musk. And I was just interested that this gentleman, Matthew Earhart, picked up on that the same way and writes fairly extensively on this matter. Again, qualify, you have to go through and qualify what he's saying and see how much of it itself holds water and how much doesn't, and then see what's left. But we need to separate the wheat from the chaff anymore, and this is Tesla's a big deal. But if it was all promotion, what was promotion, that's a big deal too. And then yet we have the subtle energy sitting there and get hidden. You can't get at them in all the hoopla, actually. Other claims are even more dubious. Tesla fans broaden the definition of invention until it loses all meaning. Tesla found that the gas-filled gas tubes glowed in the presence of his high-voltage apparatus, but modern neon and fluorescent lighting don't work this way and were developed by others. The claim that Tesla is the father of robotics stems from a story of a demonstration he performed in 1898 in which he steered a model boat in a water tank by remote control. He speculated that the electricity had curative powers and built Tesla coils for this purpose. Therefore, it is claimed that he invented dithering. He rambled about a death rays, hence he invented the laser. Little more than a sketch from the 1920s of a very peculiar biplane on casters makes Tesla the inventor of a vertical takeoff and landing VTOL aircraft. All this may be remarkably prescient, but by similar reasoning, Leonardo da Vinci invented the helicopter, and Hero of Alexandria, first century, invented the steam locomotive. About 1900, Tesla was playing with radio receivers when he picked up a series of regular pulses. He instantly concluded it was a contact from Martians, an announcement that got him considerable ridicule. Look where Elon Musk wants to go. That was an interjection. Tesla, modern admirers, perhaps a bit embarrassed for their hero, are equally sure he had tuned in on a pulsar 60 years before radio astronomers did. Considering what radio technology was in 1900, this may not be the true explanation. Tesla's death ray is something of a mystery. Some, not all admirers, insist it was actually built and used to shoot down a plane. Descriptions vary. Sometimes it is a particle beam of some sort. My favorite is it was a kind of radio wave scalar weapon, or what might be called an ultrasound gun, from the fantastic inventions of Nikola Tesla by D.H. Childers, 1993. The most intriguing of Tesla's inventions are the ones that got away. Visitors to the Tesla Museum in Colorado Springs are told of a story reminiscent of UFO conspiracy tales. In a raid on his house immediately after his death, government agents seized all of Tesla's apparatus, some 85 trunks full, either because timid bureaucrats felt the world wasn't ready for the wonders of Tesla technology or for more sinister reasons. Exactly what all this top-secret Tesla technology may be isn't known, but some of it, so goes the test story, may make time travel possible. The next heading here, Jeff Johnson debunks the Tesla coil myth. The Tesla coils and books about them are ubiquitous as Tesla exhibitions. These coils are specialized electrical transformers and spark gaps in circuits that produce high voltages at high frequencies. Often the coil has a large metal ball on the top from which streamers of electricity shoot out. Large Tesla coils can produce millions of volts and are used to make spectacular electrical displays, but that's about all. The Tesla coil has never been much more than a toy, excellent for a wide variety of adolescent mayhem, but having no important scientific or industrial applications. This device, which obsessed Tesla for the last half of his life, is now only a curiosity. Tesla admirers try to get around this embarrassing fact by claiming that Tesla coils are to be found in many places, cars and television sets, for example, a favorite example. Presumably, they are thinking of ignition coils and flyback transformers, neither of which is a Tesla coil. These things are much more sophisticated devices whose only similarity to a Tesla coil is that they all produce high voltages. Some Tesla fans go even further to imply that all transformers are Tesla coils. This is nonsense. Tesla did not invent the transformer. True, Tesla coils are not used in scientific experiments today because they are too quirky. Their voltages and frequencies vary from many causes, and they require constant adjustment. They are also very dirty electrically. They produce intense radio and TV interference. Today, scientists and engineers have far superior methods of producing high voltages, methods that do not derive from Tesla's work. And I can say, building an EMP device, we didn't use a Tesla coil at all. You can't get that kind of voltage and intensity out of that system. So, again, it's very interesting what it is and what it may not be or what it doesn't seem to be when you get into practice of it. As I said, get you behind the woodshed and you'll find out quick whether you understand what's going on or not. In the next chapter, The Occult Tesla, we will leap ahead several decades after the death of Nikola Tesla by reviewing a new human automaton made in Tesla's molding, albeit with a few upgrades. This Tesla 2.0 upgrade took from the form of a South African heir to the fascist technocracy party with the same penchant for occultism, transhumanism, and P.T. Barnum-esque showmanship exemplified by the Serbian magician. So that was the background of what I was talking about. You start looking through, critically looking at things, start to even get your fingers and your hands into it and try to do and replicate and think through what's going on. Watch what happened underneath the skin of the nation, of the industry, of all this other thing, what was going on as well, the financing of things as well. Remember, he went right through the Depression with all that as well. Today, we're looking almost similar, very similar type things. And someone pops up in history, if you will, from history, and starts to replicate that. And again, P.T. Barnum-esque, a performance can be made that lulls us into believing we're watching reality. And it's all just to distract us from what's really going on. But here, enter stage left, Tedrogenous Man, the anti-hero, moving along now with Musk in my own way. Here, 2.0, we'll have to wait for Matthew to write the rest, but we're going to move on today. Musk fires back at German magazine over public enemy claim. Elon Musk has hit back at a German magazine, Der Spiegel, after it branded the billionaire public enemy number two and claimed he is working for Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump to decompose liberal democracy. In response, Musk insisted that he's a staunch defender of democracy. Remember what I've talked about this word democracy. Understand that Der Spiegel may be saying exactly the truth relative to what they would want to see the destruction to be, yet he's going to deny it and say, no, he supports democracy, because that's what y'all here want to hear. He supports democracy, but we don't live in a democracy. Your president isn't elected by all the demos. It's only a couple and a few electors. And so this is one misstatement after another, but it's a promotion. It's an antagonism. It's a fight we get to watch. We watch all the hair pulling that goes on. The German outlet published an article on Sunday with a cover depicting a close-up of the tech mogul with Trump's features emerging through part of his face. The piece noted that ex-owner and Tesla CEO has amassed a huge, huge economic clout and a prominent media profile. Remember, the promotion of Nikola Tesla as well. Everywhere, wherever you see, to the Americans. Within a few years, he, Musk, has not only become the political right-wing hardliner, but also a declared opponent of the liberal democracy in the United States. The troll-in-chief has mutated into a political agitator. One could say Donald Trump is probably the current biggest threat to the free world. His buddy Musk is at least public enemy number two, the article said, drawing parallels with Nazi leader Adolf Hitler, who rose to power thanks in no small part to the support of the German industrial moguls. Musk addressed the accusation during a town hall meeting with American voters in Pennsylvania. I'm like enemy number two of what? Democracy? I mean, I am pro-democracy. I'm literally trying to uphold the Constitution and ensure that we have a free and fair election, he fired back, drawing cheers from the crowd. Democracy, folks? In a constitutional republic? Claiming to uphold the Constitution for the republican form seems the definition of an anti-hero character to me in this kabuki theater. Unless he's an elector, he doesn't even vote for the president pursuant to that constitution he wants to uphold. So I have to ask, which constitution then is he actually having people agree to? And now he's got a big money. If you sign up for that petition, you might be ready to get $1 million from him. So does he really know something that you don't know? Does it matter anymore in an empire declining into the stinking abyss? The billionaire added that he would definitely upgrade my security after the article, noting that he is sometimes shocked by what he sees from the left. You know, the level of vitriolic hatred on the left, which is supposed to be tolerant, they claim they are tolerant, and yet they are incredibly intolerant and spewing hate. Musk, a self-described free speech absolutist, endorsed Trump after the failed assassination attempt on the former president in July and has since donated tens of millions of dollars to his campaign. He has repeatedly expressed concern about what he describes as increasing censorship in the United States, as well as an overbearing bureaucracy that prevents any meaningful action. Meanwhile, Trump has vowed to create a Musk-led government efficiency commission to audit the entire federal government if he returns to the White House. Is government efficiency an oxymoron? And so goes the left-hand tech-drogynous man, moving stage right-ish. Or does he ultimately do neither and is the change agent efficiently affecting the American technate and to be transplanted to Mars? And is that where the initiated of the interplanetary technate rule Earth after the Great War? To subdue the people of the Earth? For their own good, of course. And that of humanity, the humanist insult. Because, as we read in the last episode, this is not a peaceful transition. Remember what I read there. They understood that no nation would knowingly or readily adopt cross-border controlling technocracy if they could see it, if they see it coming. So always remember, again, the first law of war, the encroachment, the occupation. You know them when you see them. Because the they don't have to tell you. That's international law. And that's an additional challenge you often hear about the need for transparency. What if that technate oppression is transparent to you, given you knows them when you see them? If they are transparent to you or to a nation, how do you seize them? I mean seize as in arrest them. How do you seize them? And in this article, being substantially correct in its depiction of a condition, but for the wrong reason, it does remove a bit of the camouflage exposing a potential arch-villain. If you look at the link where the link address is, look where it says, and you remove the word Spiegel, you'll see Musk, enemy Trump. And I thought that was certainly interesting in this, but I appreciated the summary that they mentioned in Esoteric Trumpism, 15 minutes of fame, food, this fast food slinging Trump as an archetype in a historical context as well. As we seems to match and is consistent to much of my general life, characterizations of the world at large, despite my ignorance as to that detailed subject matter. Our disparate past meeting here with Matthew writing that and his referencing that we've met here at the same stinking abyss. As I've said, it interests me. I hope it interests you that pursuing facts, looking at realities, trying to keep the truth alive in that without diverging brings you to the same stinking abyss. After at some point you see enough people standing shoulder to shoulder, you have to be looking at the truth. Beyond the historic context, maybe this is even the hysterical context, whether crazed or comedy. Trump admits to the first here, recently admitting to being F**ing crazy when talking about a conversation he had with Russian President Putin, referenced in the Kremlin reacts to Trump's Moscow strike threat article. Apparently the Caesar complex peaking out. Trump claiming the first, that of being crazy, the people can admit to the second, to recognize the Kabuki theater comedy, that this is a big laugh going on. And then we can then leave this clown show, roll up our sleeves to work out our way through the place of our society that best affects it for us. That was the insight began at the Declaration of Independence, together with the best of what that provided, and move beyond where the ever-present vampire squid tentacles reach to break the historic cycle of the planetary abuse that all people seem to suffer. And that view is consistent with the Achilles heel that one might identify in those that presume to know you better than you do yourself, or for those reading the Manual for the Frailties of Mankind, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which I have as a link I provide at the bottom of the blogcaster for you to read, because it speaks to all of these things, and even, the other link, The Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, allowing yourselves to be constantly plugged into a governance system circuit designed for you to benefit some parasitic capacitance, some parasitic capacity, sustainable capacity building. Sound familiar? Start putting these together, you start to see capacitance was one of the things that Tesla needed to make his things work. And so it's all, yeah, kind of like that. We pull together all these things. We look at the characters on the stage, the archetypes, the myths, and they tell a different story. They allow us to see a different story. So these last few weeks, I've been noticing this come along. I find it very interesting it's coming up now to point it out to us. If we have, I guess, have the eyes to see, and I wanted you to know about it. I don't know what y'all run across on your own, but these things are there for us to weigh and measure and decide whether we want to really engage it or find, as we see, find the path that gets us to the least evil while we're continuing to work through something to make it so that we don't even have to continue to live like that. Why Donald Trump is a mystical figure of historical proportions came up as well. The significance of the former and potential future U.S. president is not in the man himself, but in the archetype he embodies. And so now I'm going to move into some of these symbols and archetypes that are sitting in these people that we're watching that seem to move in the way that they're described as people looking in, more learned people certainly than me. This is written by Konstantin von Hofmeister, and a political and cultural commentator from Germany, an author of the book Esoteric Trumpism, and an editor and a chief of Arctos Publishing. And so we're going to touch that. I referenced it in the prior tab, moving this thing into these mystical, magical type things. But what's really going on may escape us. The significance of the former potential future president is not the man himself. So again, everything can be viewed as a symbol of things. Well, and we're getting into subtle energies here, too, as well, which I won't delve into. I just want to read this article. But all this starts to come to bear as we start experiencing, witnessing and experiencing what we're seeing. For supporters of Donald Trump, he is a bulwark of traditionalism and a champion of America first. For his detractors, he is a disruptive, deceitful agent of chaos. But a more philosophical approach frames him as a key figure in an eldritch struggle which deep-seated forces of decay. Esoteric Trumpism is a profound, almost mystical interpretation of Donald Trump's political journey, situating him not merely within the framework of a contemporary politics, but also as a figure of a cosmic and world historical significance. The interpretation posits that Trump's rise and continued influence reflect deeper metaphysical catalysts at play in the twilight of Western civilization, as predicted by the historiographer Oswald Spengler in the 1920s and 30s. So tie all these years and who was involved at all these times through history and see they're very consistent. We also have to be careful. They will form the basis of our understanding of our perception as well. So understand what that was to see if you're being lulled into that and whether or not also qualify that those views are true and they're not necessarily just lulling you into a deception, like a hypnosis. And so there's a little work going on, but we can do it. We got the technology. You certainly got to get behind the woodshed, and then you'll start to do better there. According to Spengler's cyclic theory of history, every great culture passes through the stages of growth, flowering, and decline, ultimately transforming into civilization. A civilization, in Spengler's view, is the final ossified stage of culture, marked by materialism, a dystopian government apparatus, and stagnation, where the original creative spirit has faded. In this phase, let me interject right there, so you see Musk coming up, and he's a creative spirit, at least on the surface. And yet, we're just now getting the rocketry from the 30s and 40s, so they're landing on their tails now. So the point is that we have this original creative spirit, it's almost a facade in a declining area to get us off the point of the destruction that's coming, the transformation of a society as it crumbles. And part of the situation with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and that they know you better than yourself, is that they have an Achilles heel. And my thought has been since it came to me, and I think I understand it pretty clearly, that is our power. That's how we avoid the thing may crumble that crumbles. It doesn't mean us. That's our intention now. So moving into this, in this phase, democratic institutions begin to decay, leading to the rise of autocratic leaders or Caesars, who assert their will as the last defenders of the civilization's final flickers of vitality. Trump, in this narrative, appears as a Caesar of the West, struggling against the forces of chaos and entropy that threaten to engulf the remnants of the culture's achievements. The swamp, in the context of esoteric Trumpism, eclipses its conventional political metaphor as a term for entrenched, secretive, and subversive agencies. Instead, it takes on a life of its own, representing a primordial, chthonic entity whose tentacles have reached into the heart of the American power. This is no mere political quagmire. It is an ancient force predating the Republic itself, fueled by what can only be described as eldritch energies. Trump's wrestling against this dark presence is painted in Lovecraftian tones, where the stakes are not just electoral victories or policy changes, but the very soul of the nation. His presidency begins as a metaphysical battle, with Trump cast as a modern hero who, like Spengler's envisions Caesars, refuses to capitulate to the rot that envelops his civilization. Each executive order, every political maneuver, is understood as an audacious attempt to dismantle this machinery of the great old ones that was operated unseen for centuries. Trump's defiance is portrayed as a courageous, almost tragic stand against the inevitable. He fights not for personal gain, but to stave off the encroaching darkness that looms over the West. And it's why I describe Elon Musk as an anti-hero. They can go both ways, and he's showing a good way, but he's intending what looks to be an evil, if you will, way, a dark way. According to the ontological philosopher Martin Heidegger, Dyson, literally being there, refers to the distinctive mode of existence that characterizes human beings, defined by their capacity for self-awareness and their ability to recognize and engage with their own potentialities. Unlike other beings, humans are conscious of their own existence within a temporal and historical context, aware of both their limitations and their possibilities for action. The scene is not merely being present in the world, it involves an active process of comprehending and deciphering one's place in it, constantly shaping and being shaped by one's surroundings. In this sense, the scene is not at all individual, but completely intertwined with its historic and communal context, a being in the world that is fundamentally shaped by its place within the continuum of history. Trump's populism, when viewed through this lens, can be seen as an awakening of the collective Dyson of the American people. His rhetoric of reclaiming national identity and sovereignty is hence an invocation to realize an authentic existence where individuals are no longer lost in the impersonal tyrannies of globalism and bureaucracy. Its appeal to the forgotten men and women taps into an existential angst, reconnecting individuals with their communal and historical nucleus, urging them to rise from the alienation of modern life and reassert their being in a political arena. I'm going to interject here. I think we're seeing a competitor to that in the North Carolina at this same time. What is reconnecting individuals in their communal historical nucleus is really not Trump. It's what you see in the South and East at this time as a comparison. Heidegger speaks of Dasein as a fundamentally concerned with its own temporality, aware of its eventual finitude, and driven by the need to authentically project itself into the future. Trump's populism mirrors this structure of Dasein, where he calls to make America great again, serves as a temporal bridge between a nostalgic past and a projected future that seeks to recover a lost essence. In the Heideggerian sense, Trump's movement can be seen as a collective realization of the thrownness of the American people into an inauthentic globalist existence. His populist message offers a way to reclaim historical destiny, to step out of that they self of anonymous, alienate existence, and into a more authentic mode of being. Trump also reflects the vision of the idealist philosopher George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, whose concept of the world spirit represents the unfolding of universal reason through the historical process, where the self-consciousness of freedom manifests across different nations and epochs. The dialectical feature of the world spirit reveals that nothing is permanent, for everything is in constant flux, striving toward higher realization. As Hegel affirms, quote, what is rational is actual, and what is actual is rational, and Trump's populism can be interpreted as an essential moment, a reassertion of Americans' intrinsic spirit against the imposition of the technocratic modernity. Trumpist populism reflects the nation's effort to preserve its unique manifestation of the world spirit, reinforcing patriotism as both a grounding force and a guiding principle in ever-evolving historical process. Thus, Trump completed the system of German idealism. And understand what this article also is pointing to, so be careful to just embrace it completely. It sounds really good. It is doing these subtle energy archetypal things. We can see Trump in all these points, but is that actually the interpretation? As I just said, there's a competing one that just showed up, I think, to maybe more show us where a better direction might be. Trump's economic nationalism and policies aimed at restoring America autarky through tariffs, immigration controls, and the reduction of global dependencies are emblematic of a dying civilization's last effort to preserve itself. Spengler wrote that as civilizations enter their final stages, the state becomes primarily an economic object, with the competition for resources and sovereignty taking precedence over other concerns. Trump's trade wars with China and his efforts to revive American industry are therefore not merely political strategies, but the actions of a Caesar seeking to preserve his people's material and cultural autonomy in the face of an encroaching global order. These actions reflect the Spenglerian picture of a civilization striving to maintain its vitality even as it approaches its unstoppable downfall. Let me interject on this. No different than we see the real community in the American spirit in North Carolina and in the South and the East after Helene. We are in a fiat system which should not continue, which Trump isn't saying he's going to remove. And so be careful. To my mind, I'm looking at an explanation of who Trump is, but it's another false answer. It's an answer. It is what he's doing. But again, we have control of whether we can hit the Achilles heel of those that would think they know best better than ourselves. And if we move out of the fiat system ourselves, and we do what we see an example for ourselves in North Carolina, we may have a better way to go, as an observation on my part, even reading these information that sounds really cool, the mythos, if you will. And it's a truism, and they are playing these parts, but that's not our future necessarily. This is what we're driven by in our nature. It doesn't mean we have to continue it if it's actually not what we need. In esoteric Trumpism, Trump is viewed not as an operation, but as a predetermined figure, a product of the historical moment. His strongman tendencies and his rejection of liberal democratic norms of the post-war era are seen as necessary responses to the crumbling structures of the Western governance. Esoteric Trumpism casts these traits not as flaws, but as virtues in a leader confronting the end of civilization. Like the Caesars of Rome, Trump's rise is framed as the emergence of a new form of leadership suited to the challenges of a decomposing world. Trump's confrontations with the globalist agenda, particularly in the realms of environmentalism and economic policy, further reflects Spenglerian themes. Spengler was harshly critical of the modern technocratic society, warning of its dehumanizing effects. Trump's rejection of climate change initiatives and his embrace of industrial growth can be seen as a reassertion of the Faustian spirit, a refusal to surrender to the passive nihilistic tendencies that arise in late-stage civilizations. His emphasis on economic nationalism and energy independence reflects a desire to maintain control over nature and resources in line with the Faustian quest for power that Spengler saw as a characteristic of Western civilization. Esoteric Trumpism positions the Trump phenomenon as a crucial, albeit controversial, defense against the culture and political putrefaction that has beset the West. Trump's role goes beyond mere policy decisions and enters the domain of iconic leadership, a figurehead fighting against the hydra of disillusion that has been eroding Western civilizations for decades. His rejection of wokeism and the extreme liberal agenda, which manifests its cultural policies advocating unchecked multiculturalism, radical gender ideologies, and the suppression of traditional values, exemplifies this broader conflict. Trump's pushback against these ideologies, such as his opposition to critical race theory in education and federal training programs, and his defense of free speech against social media censorship, signals a refusal to allow the progressive agenda to dissolve the cultural foundations of the West. The culture wars he has participated in are not mere skirmishes, but symbolize a larger clash between the malevolent entities seeking to dismantle the core identity of Western civilization and the guardians, like Trump, who aim to preserve it. I need to interject. Let me just say, all those things they're saying that Trump stands for is in you that believe in that, not in him. So that's what I'm saying. Our power is in us. As I read this story, and I hope you're picking that up for yourself, and I'm not, maybe I'm insulting you to say so, but this is what I read this through. Remember, we're talking about a character. These characteristics, these values are in us, if they are. And that is what he's bringing up in us. We see that in him, but he's just a talker. Remember, he did not drain the swamp. He did effect at warp speed the death of many people. Right? On and on. As I told you, be very careful on how much we put someone on a pedestal. But he can be a motive force for, if we understood it was in us and not in him, he just becomes the reminder of what is in us. And he knows how to play that. See, that's the other problem that I see here. That's why he speaks to it. In rejecting the narratives of the left, Trump represents a larger resistance to what many of the intellectual right view as an extreme liberal agenda that seeks to destabilize the traditional order. Didn't I just say it? Trump represents the larger resistance. He is not that resistance. So this is the thing about representation. It's also the representative government model. So you can see the mirror here is fairly clear in some regard too. When I'm reading this, I'm seeing three or four different things being discussed. That's why I appreciated this summary of this book so much. His first administration policy, such as a reinstating a ban on transgender individuals in the military, denouncing left-wing violence in the cities like Portland, and challenging the dominance of leftist academic thought, are framed as a necessary act to protect the West from succumbing to cultural and moral relativism. Trump, as a president, is thus seen as the essential chapter in the grand historical struggle to save the West from itself. His legacy will not be defined by his electoral victories or defeats, but by his role as the bulwark against the internal denigration that, if left unchecked, would result in the end of Western civilization as we know it. So understand this. He's talking about this as evident. Trump is the evidence of a diminishing civilization, and yet here's your Achilles heel. It's unchecked. Well, we do the checking, remember? And so there it is. That's the answer. There's part of the Achilles heel right there. Now he's got the question. Is Western civilization actually going to end? The way it's going, yes. But we need to change it. Trump's significance lies not in the man, but in the archetype he embodies. The rise of the Caesarian leaders does not promise material success. Their triumph is symbolic, not in policy, but in the rebellion against the senile and rabid world order. Trumpism, even as Trump's personal influence fades, will persist as a movement that channels the existential fears of a civilization in free fall, longing for a return to integrity and self-expression. Let me interject in that. That's the thing you reinstall for you, yourself, and those around you. Everybody does this. It returns that. You return to integrity and self-expression. The power of the archetype lies in the resonance with the people alienated by the deep state. A resonance, a frequency, sympathetic response. Notice there's no force here. Subtle energies. Trump articulates their despair even as his achievements remain modest. His role is to act as the last expression of the Western survival in a world disintegrating into frenzied insanity. Spengler leaves no room for optimism about the material success of such figures. Yet the archetype persists, drawing its strength from the same impulses that herald the end of the West historical cycle. I must say, I guess this is a BTWRLM 600. Can't believe that many numbers of episodes. I like that article quite a bit, actually. Well, I went back through and read it again here for you. I hope I didn't bore you. I hope there was lots in there. But I keep telling you, we're going to have to take the reins of this wagon, and what's for us to do as a people. And we're not going to do it. As you see, the world's not standing around, and they're not taking it anymore either. And they're going to supposedly make an independent system, which I've already told you. I just read that Russia's making agreements that MasterCard and Visa are going to be internal cards for Russia. Can't be that they're actually going to get out of that fiscal, that financial, global financial system. So this is a ruse as well. For as much of the assertion of sovereignty and self-determination that's going on in the BRICS, and for what it all sounds like on the surface, I've explained to you over many episodes how that's not really what's going on, and you watch no different. You watch how the downfall is happening on all of it. It's all going to slipping into that stinking abyss of global control. And getting back to the archetype, and we can see the stand of Trump to maintain the Western identity, the tough-talking John Wayne-esque movie, take charge, directing and, you know, acting individual, the direct action that you would take as an American spirit in this little back and forth and dismissal, essentially. The Kremlin reacts to Trump's Moscow strike threat. So you watch this play, this theater playing out in front of you, right in the news, all in the same week I'm pulling this together. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump's claim that he had threatened Russian President Vladimir Putin with a strike on Moscow is attributable to U.S. election rhetoric, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov suggested on Monday. Talking tough. That's an American way, right? Well, Russia's not putting up with it no more. And there's a couple reasons for that. They have to, as a nation. As a nation with integrity and their own sovereignty, they have to. But as I've shown you, they already know that's a joke. That's not ultimately where it's going to go anyway. We're on the threat of it. But I don't think that everyone really wants to push that button. As Putin just said, you want to go to war, nuclear war? It's going to be over in an hour. It's not going to be long and drawn out. It's all over. It's done in an hour. And that's pretty chilling. And so that's a big decision to go ahead and make. But anyway, so tough-talking, direct-acting Trump comes out and said he was going to do something, and Russia said, well, that's just election rhetoric. Puts a wet blanket all over his fire. Unfortunately, a number of world leaders do not adhere to this position, and in this case, do not observe such information hygiene, but that is on their conscience, he stressed. Peskov noted that currently there are many different fiery, very emotional statements being made in the U.S. as part of the election campaign, especially in its final stage. Dmitry Medvedev, a former Russian president and current deputy chair of the Security Council, doubted Trump's ability to fulfill his promise, insisting that Moscow would have the final say on how the conflict ends. What if Putin says, not yet, Ukraine must capitulate? And no, joining NATO. And so here's the tough talkers talking back to each other on the world stage again. And this is Trump talks tough, and they just dismiss him. From billions to trillions, talking last week about the vampire squid, and then just mentioning here, just as we're moving along, back BlackRock's investment in the Ukraine moving in through to Russia, what that's all about, the theater that's going on there. Terrible, terrible genocide going to the last Ukrainian as well. I need to ask that, contrary to the CEO Fink's statement last week, did Fink make an investment in Ukraine social party that is bad for BlackRock when he said he doesn't do it that way? We can read this story. Here's the issue behind Russia's Ukraine position that West still doesn't get. So this is where you hear a little bit of that with the Kremlin talking back to Trump. That's just dismissing. Just dismissal because it's just theater for the American electorate. It isn't real in the world. It's not functioning in the world. And the United States does not get that as they keep moving through to the last Ukrainian, essentially. The U.S., the led bloc, needs to come to terms with the fact that its strategy has completely failed and to get real about peace terms. So we don't hear a lot about the peace much, and we don't from this the West, and we don't hear anything much about diplomacy, as I've talked about, or statesmanship, and we're not hearing all that from the West. And Russia, I've told you, they do, and they are. Now we hear the word peace pop up. Peace in the West is actually war. It's a reverse of what we hear. They don't use the word same words that we in the street might think. Defense is war. That's all that seems that the Americans know, and that's not really what the Founding Fathers were about when we were supposed to not get into foreign entanglements. In this article, I'm going to skip down to the summary of what this war is about, remembering what I told you the first weekend after the sanctions were instituted, that this was not a proxy war, but a direct economic war that the United States lost in its opening salvo. That the fighting and dying to the last Ukrainian was the visual cover for the economic attack to subdue Russia. That the sanctions against Russia would be like spitting into a hurricane, or a himicane if in your needy. So let's hear what a bit of the backstory is here on this by Sergei Polutayev, an information analyst. He specializes in Russian foreign policy and in the Russian-Ukraine conflict. Someone a little closer to things than the guy behind the woodshed. We read, Joe Biden is expected to make some new decisions regarding Ukraine in the weeks leading up to the country's November elections. The United States president was supposed to attend to an important meeting with Kiev's backers at Ramstein, Germany, on October 12th, but canceled, citing the need to stay at home due to Hurricane Milton. What decisions can we expect to be made when it eventually takes place? Most likely, nothing particularly important will happen. Here's why. A unified stance. Amidst the fog of propaganda, it can be hard to discern true motives, and often these only become clear over time. I got to just go back to that, talking about the promotions of the technocrats and what they do there. We could hear a lot of promotion, but what's the truth? What's the reality? After the start of the Russian military operation in February 2022, Western media presented a unified and convincing narrative. The entire so-called free world came together to defend Ukraine, determined to deliver the strategic blow to Russian President Vladimir Putin and restore the U.S.-led global order. However, these proclamations didn't match the steps taken by the West. After all, if your goal is to defeat an opponent, shouldn't you do everything in your power to achieve it? One would think so here, don't you think? But remember, I've said from the beginning, the fighting on the ground is running a deceitful cover for the actual operation. The article goes on to explain Biden's doctrine. Why are things different now? The doctrinal principle that has shaped the West policy on Ukraine since 2014, when the United States overthrew Ukraine in a coup, is to prevent Putin from achieving his goals and do it without engaging in the direct military conflict with Russia. Biden and his administration has consistently stated that their priority is to avoid a full-on confrontation with Russia, yet this message has largely been forgotten. How does this principle align with what we have today? The largest armed conflict in Europe since World War II, in which the West is fighting Russia by means of Ukrainian army? Sure, it may not be on the same scale as Vietnam, but the military aided that is provided to Kiev is still significant. The answer is simple. The decision makers in the West, often referred to as the globalists, never truly believed that Ukraine could defeat Russia on the battlefield. Well, let's say almost never. There was one notable exception, which we'll discuss later. I say you are subject to the people in the seats of decision for a reason. These ignorant do-gooders, demented psychopaths, are the ones that are in the seats of decision for us. As we start to understand what Biden's actual policy is underneath us. It's not Biden's any either, so let's not get lost in that. But Biden's doctrine implied that the West could achieve its goals through financial and trade strategies. Recognizing that an armed conflict was looming, the globalists spent years developing an economic nuclear bomb that was supposed to bring Russia to its knees. And allow me to remind you here, an economic nuclear bomb that Russia and China saw coming and had been preparing for, as I had explained then, over a decade, and the steps being taken to bolster each their economies. Even the Obama's pivot to China, the military cover, providing the Chinese yuan to come into the global prominence as well. That same cover happened. Besides, how many nuclear bombs worth of power is expended in a hurricane, or hemicane if you're needy, that anyone would consider spitting into one? For reference, a fully developed hurricane releases the same amount of energy as the explosion of a 10-megaton nuke every 20 minutes. The NOAA article said that I read, that's more than 666, interesting number, 666 times bigger than the little boy bomb that the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima, Japan, in 1945. Therefore, it is a myth that any nuclear bomb can snuff a hurricane out. Spit into that, Biden. Taking a step back to maybe even as reflection in the International Carnival Mirror or Karma Mirror on the U.S. to see this, to convert this deluge of destruction that follows a hurricane or such as the good people of the Southeast the United States have just been subjected to, the wiping away of people and property and the ongoing hardship, the predation of the public and private sector upon the national economy. And look around, take that step back and look around. What's another lesson here then? After the U.S. had to deal with the hurricane, it isn't here to help. That is left to you all, these demented psychopaths. The decision makers, the profiteers for profit, the plan was ambitious. They assumed that unprecedented sanctions from hell would essentially block Russia's access to the outside world, plunging it into economic chaos and ultimately toppling the country's current ruling elite. We interject. How many of you and my listeners have an alternative path? I told you about what Russia was doing to make that path at the time. The article goes on to say, maybe this wouldn't happen overnight. Perhaps it would take years, but the idea was that the Russian government would eventually yield to the demands of a people suffering from sanctions and would then yield to Western demands without firing a single shot. Khrushchev, is that you? Across the pond on this side? This would only serve as a harsh lesson for Russia, but would also send a strong message to the main enemy, China. Ukraine's military resistance wasn't factored into the equation. Many will recall the Pentagon's initially estimated that Kiev would fall within 3 days. Ironically, the U.S. thought that if the 30 million strong nation found itself under Russian control, the legitimacy of which no country in the world would officially recognize, it would become an unbearable burden for Putin and would only hasten Russia's economic collapse. In reality, the globalists dramatically overestimated the West's influence over economic processes, not only in the so-called global South, but even in their own backyard. 3 years into the conflict, they still cannot prevent dual use or military goods from entering Russia, let alone everyday consumer products. Moscow quickly rerouted its trade flows, bypassing the West, found new partners, prioritized import substitutions, and despite certain challenges, achieved noticeable and sustained growth in its economy and foreign trade. That's not sustainable growth either. Not yet. They're moving into that. But sustained growth. This is a good word. Like sustained yield for the United States in forestry. All of this turned out to be beyond the Western control. So exactly as I said, as soon as the sanctions came out, I said, this has failed. This is done. So the original plan didn't work out. This prompted the West to urgently invent a new strategy. What happens when this third gamble fails as well? Well, West finally shake it off in a lethargy and make a clear choice, or will it continue to go with the flow? It seems that all the scheduled participants of the Ramstein meeting were probably happy enough at the news of its cancellation. Clearly, neither the outgoing U.S. president nor NATO's European members have any viable ideas regarding Ukraine. Because I think NATO stands for North Atlantic Terrorist Organization, doesn't it? This means that at least until the U.S. elections, Ukraine will continue to endure reverses to the accompaniment of the globalists' hollow rhetoric. So to wrap this up, there's a much more, actually, to this analysis and discernment. This was always an economic war that the United States government waged directly, not as a proxy, but directly against Russia to subdue her. The economic nuclear bomb of which was ineffectually just like spitting into a Russian hurricane. The United States and the West is now suffering the economic fallout. Just as you heard, the guy behind the woodshed explained from beginning of this, if some guy behind the woodshed can see this, my listener has to understand how much the seats of decision don't care about you, could care less about you, having no care in the world that you are harmed and will take advantage of you when you are down. Until you say enough is enough. And you mean it. And you do something about it. And in that is the silver lining exampled in the southeastern United States, people helping each other. And I hope that that help doesn't stop with the hurricane catastrophe, but reverberates out to wipe this nation clean of the corruption that has infiltrated the soil and the good name and the soul of this country and its people. Because we are watching, the archetype may be in Trump, the cause and effect for the change is in us. And I see right at the same time happening these two symbols showing up. Actually, one's not so much a symbol, is it? The one on the ground is actually causing the change, the reigniting of the passions of the of who we are as a people. Yeah, speaking of an empire in decline, failing to achieve its goals through financial and trade strategies, when super is not too duper. U.S. economy entering a new super cycle. The country is headed for a chaotic new era marked by volatility, economists say. The U.S. economy is currently undergoing a historic shift, moving into a new cycle of higher growth, persistent inflation, and geopolitical instability that is expected to reroute cash flow across the globe. The new supercycle will reportedly be marked by higher interest rates and geopolitical and economic volatility that is likely to produce the inflationary effects. Didn't we just say the blowback from the hurricane would be what the Biden strategy was about? And they just mentioned it right there. So here it is. Moreover, industrial planning is projected to be increasingly impacted by national security concerns, inevitably altering supply chains across sectors. The new supercycle, quote, puts the economy in a completely new era, close quote. The CEO of Mar Vista Investments, Silas Myers, told the news outlet, warning that the whole generation of investors, lenders, and entrepreneurs had failed to embrace the profound impact that the change will have on their business. The previous supercycle emerged in 2008. So understand what they're talking about here. The supercycle isn't so duper. When the Fed slashed the key rate to 0% in response to the global financial crisis that caused major turmoil, what's a barrel of turmoil worth now, folks, around the world, as a result, yields on treasury bonds tanked, and meaning investors had to start taking some serious risks if they wanted to make money. Well, that doesn't exist. He means to acquire more debt. What else do you acquire in a debt system? Read. Super cheap debt made it easy for businesses to overexpand and overhire, Josh Hurt, a senior economist of the Vampire Squid Vanguard, said. Money managers and corporations currently have to adapt to a changing set of economic realities, and stressing that one of these clearest signs that the new cycle is arriving is when the financial rules stop working the way they used to. And notice the break with gold on some other cycles now. It just happened. A mismanaged empire in decline, the last throes of a corrupted system, Trump is merely a symbolic antagonist to, if we just adapt what we just heard in that other article. Because Trump can't do anything that has already been to the people of the country to do for themselves. Because being free is not a spectator sport. He's a symbol. You're going to have to take these reins in your hands and get out of that system. Remove the debt from yourselves as best as you can and quickly. And then move with your best intention and spirit and integrity into the future you want. Because the government's not there to do that. Those that run the seats of decision aren't there to do that. And because it doesn't have a lab it can burn, all that needs to be said is, sorry, Mulder, Pentagon says there is no hard evidence of aliens visiting the Earth. After years of speculation, alleging sightings, hoaxes, and conspiracy theories, the United States military has finally set the record straight on claims that extraterrestrial spacecraft could have visited our planet. Pentagon Press Secretary Major General Patrick Ryder this week made it clear exactly what the U.S. military reportedly knows about aliens' alleged visits to Earth. Quote, the truth is out there, Jeff. And the truth is we have no evidence to indicate extraterrestrial life has visited the planet, he told Task and Purpose reporter Jeff Skogel during a press event on Thursday when the latter asked him what the Pentagon knows about aliens and UFOs. So if there is no hard evidence, how did they have any evidence to support the truth for what they have no evidence for that the Pentagon says it's out there? Without evidence to say that. But let's look at the fortuitous utility that no hard evidence might offer to the government to not admit to the truth while it does the catbox cover-up to keep itself in relevance here, or evasion of the truth. Speaking of people believing myths and fairy tales, Americans believe the NED, Fairy Tale Newland's new position in a nonprofit. Dr. Jeremy Kuzmorov, an editor and author, wrote for Covert Action magazine, told the Critical Hour on Thursday to discuss Newland's new role in a nonprofit group which works to assist those abroad who are working to build democratic institutions and spread democratic values, according to the organization's program. We just read Biden's theory was, we're going to do it economically. Democracy had nothing to do with it, did it? So these are all the people that are just the players. The National Endowment for Democracy, NED, announced in mid-September that it would be appointing Victoria Nuland to its board of directors effectively immediately. Nuland holds a lengthy political career in the United States as worked to promote a foreign policy of intervention, coups, proxy wars, aggression, and occupation in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Ukraine, said Kuzmorov. So where's the peace and diplomacy and statesmanship here with these people? See, the people live in are a myth anyway, that all this is supposed to is working, and it's not. And so we're susceptible to be having our innermost desires fanned so that we resonate with the one who we believe is going to best do that for us instead of saying, no, I've got to do it for myself. Firstly, these kind of people, they should be sent to the front line themselves and see if they like being in the trenches in eastern Ukraine or the H asterisk 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 hole that they created from their comfortable offices in Washington, said Kurzmorov. Newland will continue to wield influence on the foreign policy establishment, on the direction of U.S. policy now with the National Endowment for Democracy, which specializes in promoting propaganda and basically subversion in countries around the world that are targeted by the United States regime change. And I've told you, democracy essentially means making war on whomever it's directed to. Newland fits very well within why the technocrats won't be liked. We're going to bring direct democracy. Everyone's going to pretend that they have a say, and they have no say whatsoever. Because the final say is, as I've told you, agencies under advisory councils in lead situations, they make the final determination, and everybody's voice is heard. You speak till you're blue in the face, and then they can dismiss you. But Newland fits very well with this crowd, particularly as a key architect of one of the greatest humanitarian disasters in modern history, the Ukraine War, which NED and the neoconservative establishment has fervently championed, Kurzmov writes. In a separate article, Kurzmov writes that after World War II, U.S. banking interests such as the Federal Reserve pushed for the creation of the CIA as the enforcement arm of U.S. foreign policy that was expert in propaganda. So banking is in interests here. You mean the same ones that canceled Barron Trump and Melania Trump and helped nick Trump's ear? That CIA protected in banking interest? And in 1981, he notes, CIA Director William Casey told President Ronald Reagan that, quote, we will know our disinformation program is completely complete when everything the American public believes is false, close quote. Since then, the CIA has worked with the rest of the national security state, including government support think tanks, mainstream media, and nonprofits, to further the disinformation program, Kuzmov writes, citing Richard C. Cook, an author of A Retired U.S. Federal Analyst. Deagle, is that you? CIA works to create a depleted world population of compliant zombies, drained of created energy, incapable of independent thinking, riddled with fear, obedient to every conditioned impulse, running from every virus, hating every designated enemy, parroting the mass media, spending as advertising directs, numbed by drugs and medication, and ready to die at the whim of their masters, writes Cook, who served under President Jimmy Carter in an NASA and the U.S. Treasury. Quote, the CIA has perpetrated academia, the media, and they spread disinformation. They spread this false narrative about U.S. foreign policy, that it's altruistic, that it promotes democracy abroad, that it's not like former colonial powers out of the exploit of the economic resources. And that's totally false, but many Americans believe that the NED fairy tale narrative because they control all universities and they purge academics who present a kind of leftist critical analysis, the analysts say. The academics have been purged mostly from the academy today, just like in the media. You won't hear critical voices in the Washington Post or New York Times or critical analysis of the economic imperatives or some of the genocidal policies, he added, although occasionally it does filter out like Israel's genocide because it's so egregious. Citing Cook, Kuzmorov also writes that the U.S. proxy war with Russia is an attempt to sever relations between Germany and Russia so that the two cannot collectively challenge the Anglo-American hegemony. The most significant result of this plot, he adds, was the blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which would have interlinked Germany and Russia's economies and fueled an economic boom in Germany. So get back. Do you think that this is fighting on the ground, or do you think that Biden's, as the article other said, tells us, this was an economic attack? That's all this ever was. I've never really thought that the fighting was anything. People are dying, but that's not the point. That's not what's going on. That's a cover. People die as a cover for nothing more than someone's profit and control of somebody else. NED was very active in the instance, for instance, in Ukraine before the coup, which Newland played a crucial role. I mean, she's a natural fit for NED. But NED set the groundwork for financial groups, mobilizing them together to wave this Maidan Square uprising that toppled the pro-Russian leader Kuzminov claim. And they framed it as this great pro-democracy movement toppling the Russian-backed tyrant, and meanwhile, they ushered in a tyranny in Ukraine and plunged the country into civil war, and they were basically used for the U.S. aid agenda, trying to attack and destabilize Russia, he added. And it's such a disaster for Ukraine's population and the death of those young, at least 500,000 youth have died in Ukraine. Newland will continue to wield influence on the foreign policy establishment, on the direction of the U.S. policy now with the National Endowment for Democracy, which specializes in promoting propaganda and basically subversion in countries around the world that are targeted by the U.S. regime change. I said it again. That's what we believe in, a myth, because that's what's really going on. They finance civil society groups. They often provoke students to revolt against the government. They finance media outlets that will spread incendiary propaganda to countries that have more nationalistic and left-leaning policies that the U.S. corporations don't like. Newland will be here to wreck. Newland will do her wreck. You know, she's a wrecking ball, and will do it now for the NED, which she also has done at the State Department. And this is what's representing the American people. This is partly why we're a nation, an empire in decline. There's people in these offices that are no longer in having the American spirit. They have some other spirit. And it's going to be for us to wrest that back. But we are kind of out of practice, I think, as a people. And no, I don't think that, again, the Second Amendment pulls us out of this one. This is too obscure, actually. And the esoteric view, the subtle energies view, wouldn't really allow this anyway. But reflecting on the Pentagon's lack of evidence here, we can get an inkling as to why that is, that they have no evidence, where we can hear the United States Defense Chief say, too many civilians killed in Gaza, but no evidence of genocide. Sorry, Mulder, we see nothing. We don't have any evidence of genocide being committed, Mr. Austin told the Senate Armed Services Committee. And that's despite 15 judges of the ICJ finding evidence. And notice he doesn't describe the measure for his determination. So if the Pentagon does not see any evidence of genocide, the Zionista regime's intention to indiscriminately kill Palestinians and cause their removal from their own land, I guess it could be said the truth is out there. But to find it might incriminate us or expose other secrets we keep from you, right? As the contagious virus spreads to the State Department, Blinken calls genocide case against Israel meritless. Meritless meaning, I know nothing, I see nothing. Apparently, just like Sergeant Schultz, that character in the TV comedy Hogan's Heroes, that always knew nothing or saw nothing. Or how? And we watched the characters play their game, play their part, while people die, while people are destroyed, while a nation is being destroyed with it, America. And all we have left is a symbol in Trump, who I'm not sure many people understand. He's stating the things that are in the people that think he is talking for them. The U.S. government can admit to seeing and knowing of war crimes, just not hard enough evidence or sufficient enough to determine genocide. On the other hand, no act to stop those war crimes, it does admit to knowing about, despite having the obligation and duty, legally and lawfully, morally here, if lawful is. White House has not seen a sufficient evidence of genocide in Ukraine. We have seen atrocities. We have seen war crimes. We have not yet seen a level of systematic deprivation of life of the Ukrainian people to rise to the level of genocide, but again, that's something we will continue to monitor. But notice, this would have been against Russia, but the statement does not clarify that the Ukraine regime was the one attacking those Ukrainian people mentioned, where the ones on the east border targeted for extermination for their Russian orientation and the use of the Russian language. They were going to be removed from the face of the earth. Did Sullivan forget to see or mention the vast mineral wealth that the West wants to control, or through the such vampire squid financialists, the developers as BlackRock? So the U.S. won't see the evidence pointing back to it or its agenda? Or that similarly, the State Department lawyers concluded that China committed crimes against humanity in Xinjiang, but not enough proof to prove genocide in a court of law? Insufficient, meaning they do have evidence? Not unlike the Pentagon saying that there's no hard evidence. Hard evidence, evidence, but not hard enough. What was the measure of the unstated evidence applied to? What did they use? You'll seemingly never hear that measure, or if evidence even exists, the weight applied for the objective determination. So there is evidence, but we won't tell you our measure or the weight applied in making that determination, because we, the magi, have to keep the air and mystique of authority, the keeper of the knowledge. You aren't even entitled to know the elements required to help, because that is an other part of the mystic, to keep you ignorant, distracted, and fighting with yourselves, so you never pull back the curtain to find the empire wears no clothes, stating as you are the obedient consumer of what they produce. Because the truth is out there, folks. But how do you know that? And who in America can objectively disagree with this comment? No justice in the West, says Putin. No justice in the West. Who can objectively disagree with this? Moscow aims to end the impunity of the U.S. and its allies, the Russian president has said. Moscow has had enough with the West's impunity and hypocrisy and intends to ensure that there is justice in the world again, Russian President Vladimir Putin has said. Isn't this a similar justice that the symbol called Trump is speaking to as well, that invokes in us people that thing? He himself is a symbol only to, but not the thing to do. Remember that. Sitting in each one of us, the answer. Putin spoke to journalists, including many from the Western outlets, at the end of the BRICS summit in Kazan, Russia, on Thursday. Quote, "It is just a lie to our faces that NATO will not expand and then expand it," Putin asked BBC's Steve Rosenberg in response to his inquiry. "Is it fair to carry out a coup d'etat spitting on all the principles of law?" When you see unaccountability for official dereliction to the principles of law, as everyone experienced in the great Kobe swindle, is there justice at home? Let's put effect to his words. Is it a fairy tale to carry out a coup d'etat spitting on all the principles of law and funding a coup in Ukraine, he added, referring to the Maidan revolution in 2014 backed by Washington. Is it just? There is no justice here, Putin said. We want to change this, and we will. So my question for my listener is, as you see the governments flout the principles of law, our government flouts that law to enslave you, criminalize you, as a perpetually punish you with your civil rights. Remember, 42 U.S.C. 1981, go read it. The powers of the government there to extort from you as its property. Remember, it's a municipal law. My question is, has my listener had enough of the West's impunity and hypocrisy to intend and commit to take action to ensure that there is justice in your world again? And that reminds me to say, since Real Liberty Media does not extort from its listeners through force and threat, would my listener make a generous donation either through PayPal or for a cup of coffee or three at ko-fi.com? to pull us through the donation need we have, the last little bits, and which we still need for hardware. Could someone top off that coffee pot for us? Let's maybe make Juan Valdez's donkey real busy hauling coffee beans for reallibertymedia.com. And thank you again for what y'all have donated. It's being put for use right now as I speak. And I understand a very generous donation, and we pulled in within 80% of our goal. So the period ends here in about a week and a half. If you can step up and help that out, I'd appreciate it. I understand, too, the work here is to consolidate efficientize, if you go, make it more efficient for the network website to work. And that work should be beginning in about a week to start that process. So that's being determined by a scheduling situation to finish this whole thing up pretty quickly, I understand, when it gets going. The commodity monetization of production begins here in the world, with Putin also leading the charge toward the world that they want under the color of sustainable goals and food security, as we read, again, the duality, at least the duality that's going on in all of this. But Putin proposes BRICS, BRICS-based grain exchange. Now, I've talked about this commoditization of value, which is going to start to happen. Remember the basket of currency. They're not talking about the SDR, but it's right back there. I've already told you that they've already admitted that it sits back there. They're making different types of discussions, like the unit, and they are talking about their basket and the currency, using the national currencies. It's all the same, just coming a little bit different disclosure. But now we see the commodity, the grain-based exchange, the bourse, which is like a stock exchange in Europe. The bourse would protect members of the group from outside interference and excessive market volatility, the Russian leader has said. A number of BRICS countries are among the world's largest producers of grain, vegetables, and oil seeds, and we propose opening a BRICS grain exchange, which would facilitate the formation of fair and predictable price indicators for products and raw materials, taking into account their special role in ensuring food security, the Russian leader stated. So as to understand this, it's not setting up an international grain co-op to better feed people, if you read carefully. This grain exchange is the attachment of the monetization value to production. What countries and ultimately sustainable plantation slaves, what we the people will produce. Where do we see that? Does it say the platform is the help for their economies to be fully realized and realizing their full growth and potential? So this platform they're setting up is to help their economies fully realize their growth potential. Now, how do they do that? Who determines their potential? The bean counting, energy credit mongering technocrat will, and for efficiency, of course, if you put this together. Why is growth important? Important enough to interject in that sentence. Why not just to realize their potential on their own? Because growth is required in the global fiat debtor, not a master B, usurious energy deficit system of the technocrat. No one can be content with just what one has or needs. That parasitic vampire squid can't thrive if their host stops producing for both of them. So you must continually produce. And more in the global plantation to pay your perpetual debt to society and to the energy efficiency overloads that are coming in the future to collect all this up if Putin organizes it. Putin suggests this production-based nationalized work camp construct can eventually be, quote, transformed into a full-fledged commodity market. If and you don't think he has a clear direction that this is already going. How would you like your monetary system ruled by banksters string-pulling Wall Street? Remember, production requires property, but the technique allows no property, and so goes any right you thought you had and any due process you believed you were entitled to when there's no profit. It's not that this production-based international co-op is a bad relative to food distribution. It is that it doesn't have to be done under warm and fuzzy pretense, aligning with sustainable development, such as food security, to accomplish its purported goal. If Putin desires to supply full free grain to a number of African nations, as it says in the article, he doesn't need to allow this elaborate mechanism or to monetize it at all under some coded sustainability term called food security, in which in the U.S. we've already and are already experiencing as a modernization act, ostensibly enacted to address food security, but which, and predictably, won't and didn't and don't help any bit at all. They make things worse. They make things more expensive. They make things less wholesome. It's not needed that the BRICS supports the creation of a new technology platform to strengthen development cooperation, including by creating high-tech products using domestic technological potential to fuel sustainable and inclusive growth, or to make, as the declaration supports, Russia's proposal to create a grain exchange to promote rules-based trade in agricultural products and fertilizer at minimized disruptions, which sounds suspiciously like rules-based order decried by the Russians. Russia nor other country needs any of that to do what's right for them and to give as they may want to give. But the truth of these distractions and the actual goal can readily be seen in the 33-page Kazan declaration that was issued by BRICS, the BRICS leaders following a range of multi-format readings. It was entitled Strengthening Multilateralism for Just the Global Development and Security. That's what this thing was titled about. It's for global development. But to whose security, really? And who or what is determining what just is? And not merely just, but globally just. And you don't really think about, you know, government solving things or without the monopoly of force that it uses, or for behavioral control either, I mean, when you get to this level. So might I turn the attention of my listener to the post-Hurricane Helene, North Carolina, again, or the great Comey swindle, to see that the deeds and the fruits and nuts of unaccountable response. So, as usual here, we look out at the reality, and there appears to be a sleight of hand going on upon the unwary, even in the form of a national leaders, unless a particular nation's leader is really a global change agent. So how can the BRICS strengthen global development when BRICS is dealing with only just over 30 countries representing approximately 46% of the world's population and in opposition to the West? How do you globally develop less than half unless this is ultimately a globalization plan in the premier steps to it and eventually toward that one world governance? That BRICS is ultimately for global development, not to less than half, and not merely for those in the BRICS club, which club you ain't in either, except in, as eventually a token citizen, commoditized product with a QR code, the UPC product code tracking digital identity, which can also be used to club you like a baby seal. So don't forget, it's beginning right now, as I described it would. BRICS Plus is about bringing lesser economies into parity with the greater before universalizing all the economies through sustainable, equitable, global financial servitude under the existing global financial system I introduced in the prior episode. But to accomplish here that, the financial globalization, all greater economies must be brought low, subdued, and be brought into much more austerity. And you're watching that transformation happening concurrently as well, all at the same time. And this completed destruction, this transformation is going to happen at home, wherever you be, globally, unless the people stop it. So you have to start to cleave your way in the world from those of the world. And we're informed, can be informed if we will allow it. The silver is mine and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts, as we can read in Haggai 2.8. And having three critical characteristics, they're divine origin, the intrinsic value, and the monetary quality. So maybe it is wise to start there as a tool, not to worship or hoard, because, as we'll also read, their silver and gold are not able to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord, but they shall not satisfy their souls, neither their bowels, because it is a stumbling block to their iniquity. And because all the private property is not inclusive, is a stumbling block for the globalists. Don't let the they take any other property, which gold and silver are, why you want to go there in the first instance. And you do want to keep them from taking the property, no matter how warm and fuzzy that tyranny of the world sounds. And these are clues, as we're being given right in the news, the notice of what's going on, and it's explaining a path. And it may not be so simple, and it won't be so simple and easy. In a way, it's really simple. We just have to make that right decision and go there. Take the road less traveled. Right, Gary? Just right over there. And make those right decisions and start to take yourself away from those things of the world. I hope something I said today inspires you to look around, take action, get encouraged by people who are taking action, do some action yourself. Please do donate to the network to keep this word going out, and hopefully others. I've been hoping for more hosts, and that will be nice to see a more full schedule. This has been VTWRLM 600, but I'll be with you next week. Tech Tips, or nature willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, fierce and free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, lessons to learn. Dose by dose, behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. Hal's words ignite, the airwaves burn. Stand up, listen, it's time to learn. Behind the woodshed, where truths are earned. Law to liberty, the spectrum line in Hal's court, no place to hide. A cantaloupe bass ready to burst for unspoken truths and unquenchable thirst. Behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. House words ignite, the airways burn. Stand up, listen, it's time to learn. Behind the woodshed, where truths are earned. So mark the time when Sunday comes. Behind the woodshed, beating drums, house voice, a beacon, and bold in the fight for truth. Next week, heed the call. Behind the woodshed, standing tall.